Ken Davis is from the psychology. He's going to be speaking. Is Christian belief conducive to doing good science?
Thank you. Explanation. This is an unadulterated talk. I'm not going to edit it at all. That I gave as a 20-minute presentation. It came in 10 seconds within 20 minutes at Oregon State University back in February. It was a debate that I had with a former Christian named Bernie Daler, whom some of you know, who's a secular humanist minister in Portland, Oregon. It was sponsored by the Socratic Club, which is a debate society at Oregon State. So I'm just going to treat it as if it were the occasion and roll. Is Christian belief conducive to doing good science? Yes. I will argue that Christian faith often complements the picture of the world coming from the sciences, helping us to achieve a deeper understanding of both the way the world is and how we should go about understanding it, while providing a more powerful motive for investigating nature. The Christian doctrine of creation helps us to understand more of reality than science alone can study, including the very possibility of science itself as a form of knowledge about nature. The tone of my position is no less important than the content. I'm not trying to show that every open-minded, well-informed, rational person must draw the same conclusions that I draw. There are no slam-dunk answers to jump-shot questions. And questions about the existence of God, the intelligibility of nature, and the meaning of life are of just this sort. The enormous success of science in explaining so many features of the natural world is partly a result of limiting its methods and scope to things that can be measured and tested against nature, deliberately leaving all other matters to one side, but not debunking those matters as meaningless. Richard Dawkins vehemently disagrees. I beg your pardon. This is not working. So. Richard Dawkins vehemently disagrees with the point I just made. When he asked himself, what is the meaning of life? This was his answer. If science has nothing to say, it's certain that no other discipline can say anything at all. The arrogance of such a claim, dismissing in 17 words the significance of all art, music, literature, and everything else that a human person has ever thought about this question, apart from science, is staggering. However, Dawkins doesn't really speak for the whole scientific community when he says such things. He speaks only for himself and those who happen to agree with him. A different opinion comes from the late Peter Medawar, a Nobel laureate biologist. No, back the other way. Sorry. There we go. Who, like Dawkins, did not believe in God. The existence of a limit to science is made clear by its inability to answer childlike questions having to do with first and last things. Questions such as, how did everything begin? What are we all here for? What is the point of living? It is not to science, therefore, but to metaphysics, imaginative literature, or religion that we must turn for answers to questions having to do with first and last things. It is to those first and last things that I now turn. I'll start with a famous statement from the greatest scientist of the last century, Albert Einstein. The most incomprehensible thing about the world is the fact that it is comprehensible. He was referring implicitly to two different aspects of nature, its regularity and the fact that our minds can delve deeply into it, producing a coherent picture of reality. Again, this is it's wandering. Yeah, there we go. Sorry. Like my predecessor, I'm having technical difficulties. Both are prerequisites for the very possibility of doing science, and they happen to match perfectly the biblical notion of creation. What exactly do I mean by creation? An idea that might easily be misunderstood if I don't spell it out. Christopher Kaiser, a Harvard-trained astrophysicist and theologian, puts it like this. The basic idea of creation in Scripture is that the entire universe is subject to a code of law which was established at the beginning of time. This idea has two major implications for our view of the world. First, Nature functions with a high degree of autonomy, meaning literally having its own laws. And two, the natural world is comprehended by God and therefore comprehensible to human beings created in the divine image. I lack time to expand on Kaiser's claim with specific passages from the Bible and the great theologians. Suffice it to say that the term lex naturae, law of nature, appears very early in Christian thought, no later than the 4th century, when Ambrose used it in his Latin paraphrase of the Hexameron by Basil of Caesarea. Christian theologians made the concept commonplace long before scientists picked up the term. Precisely because it has such strong theological overtones, philosopher of science Nancy Cartwright, a prominent atheist, has even recommended that scientists stop using the language and the concept of natural law altogether. Without God, there cannot be laws of nature, nor anything else with their crucial characteristics, as she has said. Cartwright's conclusion flatly contradicts a widely publicized claim made by astrophysicist Lawrence Krauss, a self-described anti-theist. According to Krauss, advances in cosmology and particle physics have made it clear that there's a plausible case for understanding precisely how a universe full of stuff, like the universe we live in, could result literally from nothing by natural processes. And therefore, we don't need a creator. Frankly, this is all bluster. Krauss's pronouncement goes far beyond science, immersing him in philosophical and theological waters that are much deeper than he realizes. David Albert, an atheistic philosopher of physics at Columbia, deftly exposed Krauss's astonishing naivete in the New York Times, concluding that none of Krauss's ideas amount to anything even remotely in the neighborhood of creation from nothing. Physicist Paul Davis is equally unimpressed by claims of this sort. It is all very well proclaiming that the laws of physics plus the initial cosmic conditions explain the universe. But this begs the question of where the laws and conditions came from in the first place. Science may be powerfully successful in explaining the universe, but how do we explain science? Why does science, based on the notion of eternal laws of physics, work, and work so well? Now, many natural laws are explained mathematically. This feature of the universe has strong theological overtones, leading countless Jewish and Christian scientists to quote a creation text from the Book of Wisdom, which is probably the most quoted biblical text I'm aware of on the part of natural philosophers historically. It's not in the Protestant Bible, but this is it. Thou hast ordered all things in measure and number and weight. Something remarkable is going on here. Many years ago, Nobel laureate Eugene Wigner wrote a famous paper with a fascinating title, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. The enormous usefulness of mathematics in the natural sciences is something bordering on the mysterious, he confessed, and there is no rational explanation for it. This is not a trivial point. It is a profound fact about our encounter with the universe, and it cries out for a deeper explanation. If mathematics is merely a human invention, and our minds are nothing more than the product of a blind evolutionary process that guarantees only our survival, not the truth of our mathematical propositions, then why do our equations describe nature so well? As Paul Davis has observed, survival depends on an appreciation of how the world is, not of any hidden underlying order. Certainly, it cannot depend on the hidden order within atomic nuclei, or in black holes, or in subatomic particles that are produced on Earth only inside particle accelerator machines. This suggests that mathematics has some element of transcendence about it, suggesting in turn the possibility of a transcendent cause of the match between mathematics and matter. Now, whether they're mathematical or not, scientific laws summarize an enormous body of observations, giving them conceptual shape while helping us to predict the results of future observations. They arise out of the interplay of reason and experience that lies at the heart of modern science. Although few scientists today are aware of it, there are actually deep connections between theism and the idea that we ought to learn about nature first and foremost by observing it. Living at a time when we are confronted with enormously speculative claims about an inconceivable number of undetectable universes, it's worth remembering something that Galileo's spokesman Salviati said to Simplicio in his famous book about the Copernican system. Our discourses must relate to the sensible world and not to one on paper. One vestige of the theology underlying the modern scientific attitude is the presence in most scientific papers of two words, facts and data. They come from Latin words meaning made and given, silently reminding us that the facts pertain to things God has made and that data are given to us by the author of nature. To take this further, I call on Alexander Koyré, a Jewish scholar of great erudition whose influence on the history of science in the last century was nothing short of profound. I happened to study with a keen disciple of Koyré, the late Richard Westfall, author of the definitive biography of Isaac Newton, and I share Westfall's admiration for Koyré. Reflecting insightfully on the foundational conceptions underlying Newton's science, Koyré said this, "As we see, empiricism and metaphysics, and even a very definite kind of metaphysics, the creationist, are closely linked together. What other means, indeed, but observation and experience can we possibly use for the study of a world freely created by an infinite God?" During the scientific revolution, a great debate took place between the empiricists and the rationalists, with a crucial theological component. The rationalists, such as René Descartes, Baruch Spinoza, and Gottfried Leibniz, held that reason alone was sufficient to discover the fundamental laws of nature. That was actually their position, not exaggerating that. The empiricists, including Francis Bacon, Robert Boyle, and Isaac Newton, held that science could not be done in an armchair. Observation and experiment were essential components. This irreducible difference of opinion shines through something Leibniz told Christopher Huygens. "Mr. Boyle," he said, "spends too much time, to be truthful, drawing from an infinity of splendid experiments, no other conclusions than those which he could have taken for principles of nature, which we can certify to be true from reason alone, whereas experiments, no matter how numerous, cannot prove them." Now, what did Christian theology have to do with this debate about how science should be done? Well, listen to these words from the preface to Isaac Newton's great book, The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. "The business of true philosophy is to derive the natures of things from causes truly existent, and to inquire after those laws on which the great creator actually chose to found this most beautiful frame of the world, not those by which he might have done the same had he so pleased. Anyone presumptuous enough to think that he can learn the laws of nature from pure reason must either suppose that the world exists by necessity, and by the same necessity follows the laws proposed, or, if the order of nature was established by the will of God, that himself, a miserable reptile, can tell us what it was fittest to be done." Robert Boyle, who helped create the modern laboratory and its methods, said exactly the same thing. "For if we believe God to be the author of things, it is rational to conceive that he may have made them commensurate rather to his own designs in them than to the notions we men may best be able to frame of them. The author of nature consulted not in the production of things with human capacities, but first made things in such manner as he was pleased to think fit, and afterward left human understandings to speculate as well as they could." Another example comes from Michael Faraday, one of the most important scientists who has ever lived and one of the most intensely religious. The late Cornell historian L. Pierce Williams, the author of the standard biography of Faraday, made very interesting observations about this. Although Williams was an atheist, he notes with admiration how Faraday drew more than strength from his religion. It gave him both a sense of the necessary unity of the universe, derived from the unity and benevolence of its creator, and a profound sense of the fallibility of man. Both are worth stressing. The origins of field theory are to be found in Faraday's detailed experimental researches on electricity, but the speculations and imaginings which led him to publish Physical Heresies owe something to the unquestioning belief in the unity and interconnections of all phenomena. This belief, in turn, derived from his faith in God as both creator and sustainer of the universe. As with each of these examples, for centuries, Christian theology has been closely linked with a humble attitude toward human knowledge and a genuine openness to finding wholly unanticipated, even seemingly irrational things in nature. And this is surely conducive to doing good science. Indeed, we have an identical opinion from none other than Thomas Henry Huxley, famously known as Darwin's bulldog for his eagerness to defend Darwin's theory of evolution when it was still a brand new idea in the mid-19th century. He was no Christian. He coined the word agnostic to describe his own position, but he understood that science and Christianity have this in common. Science seems to me to teach in the highest and strongest manner the great truth which is embodied in the Christian conception of entire surrender to the will of God. Sit down before fact as a little child, be prepared to give up every preconceived notion, follow humbly wherever and to whatever abysses nature leads, or you shall learn nothing. The relevance of the Christian understanding of creation for doing science should now be evident, but I will conclude with a complementary observation. Doing science actually enhances the Christian life, making one a better disciple of Jesus Christ. Here boils palpable excitement in this passage about the telescope. Though heaven be an object that has been perpetually and conspicuously exposed to men's view and curiosity for some thousands of years, yet it still affords new subjects for their wonder. And I scarce doubt that by the further improvement of telescopes, posterity will have its curiosity gratified by the discovery both of new constellations and of new stars in those constellations that are known to us already. We need not, therefore, fear that our admiration of God should expire for want of objects fit to keep it up. That boundless ocean contains a variety of excellent objects that as little are to be exhausted as the creatures that live in our sublunary ocean or lie on the shores that limit it can be numbered. Yet this pales in comparison with the sheer rapture that fills Kepler's works from cover to cover. For it is precisely the universe which is that book of nature in which God the Creator has revealed and depicted his essence and what he wills with man in a wordless script. Or as he said on another occasion, since we astronomers are priests of the Most High God with respect to the book of nature, it behooves us that we do not aim at the glory of our own spirit, but above everything else at the glory of God. Christianity encourages scientists to seek the glory of God and the charitable service of our fellow human beings, rather than self-aggrandizement, an ever-present danger for top scientists. As Boyle realized, the higher degree of knowledge that the scientist attains seems more likely to puff him up than to make him humble. And he noted how the challenges of laboratory life could teach one humility instead. This reminds me of Bacon's famous advice about the book of God's word and the book of God's works, namely, that we should endeavor an endless progress or proficience in both. Only let men beware that they apply both to charity and not to swelling, that is, to ego building, to use and not to ostentation. And again, that they do not unwisely mingle or confound these learnings together. I close with Boyle's advice to other scientists. In an age when so many allow differences of opinion to degenerate into vulgar name-calling, railing at a man's person or wrangling about his words is a quarrelsome and injurious way of writing that does very much misbecome both a philosopher and a Christian. Thank you for your kindness in listening to my words. And thank you for your assistance with this machine here.
It's hard to follow the hand motions.
Yeah.
We got about 5 minutes of questions for Ted, and then maybe we could just do another 5 minutes for all three of the folks. So.
Paul?
Yeah. In the history of science, of course, sometimes. In the history of science, sometimes experiments preceded discoveries, and sometimes theory preceded discoveries. For example, Maxwell's electromagnetism or Einstein's relativity, they preceded observations, right? And so there's a back and forth, there's an interplay between these. And so I can't entirely dismiss Leibniz and the continental approach to this. How do you balance those out?
I think that's a great question. I think balance is the right word. I described the scientific attitude, which I'm hesitant to call the scientific method, because I don't think the scientific method singular exists. But the scientific attitude as rational empiricism, that's the term Ryer Hodekost used for it, combination of reason and experience. It wasn't as though the empiricists were saying that reason has no role. But what they were saying is you have to check against the reality external to ourselves, so whether these imaginations of our mind are actually real. Concerning Maxwell, let me put it this way. I had a part of text I'd had to cut for the presentation originally, and it bears on this this issue of how this of a physical reality versus imagination. If you go to the library and you borrow the 9th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica from 1878, it's hard to find these days. You know, they throw the New York Public Library, just cleared out 3 million volumes about 3 or 4 years ago and left these vast empty shelves, morons running the show. But if you go to the library and you borrow the 1878 edition of Encyclopedia Britannica and you read James Clerk Maxwell's article on the ether, you'll learn all about the density, shear strength, elasticity, and physical constitution of that wonderful stuff that was once universally accepted as the medium for life, right? The only problem is you couldn't find it. And that's why you won't find articles about it in scientific journals today. Now, ironically, Maxwell's ether had a much more impressive record as a scientific theory than multiverse, for example, has established so far. And his ether actually predicted the existence of electromagnetic radiation traveling at the speed of light, an astonishing result that Heinrich Hertz confirms experimentally. Yet we no longer believe in the ether that Maxwell needed to draw that conclusion. So, you know, that's kind of the balance of these kinds of things.
Ted, can you tell us a little bit more about your debate, and what was the premise of your opponent in that debate?
Well, you can watch the debate on YouTube, and if you want the link for this, just ask me for it. Send me an email. I can send it to you, including the aftermath. It was a 20-minute presentation by each of us, and then there was a lot of interplay from that point and audience questions.
Who did you debate?
I debated Bernie Daler, who was an ASA member briefly, and he'd been to a few of our meetings several years ago. He came out of a very, very conservative, I would say fundamentalist background, and was a creationist, who kind of slid quickly out of that position into atheism. He was harbored in the ASA for a couple of years while he was on his way out. He's a secular humanist minister in Portland, Oregon, and he's written a very short little book that you can get from Amazon that is called, I forget the title, but the essence of it is How Modern Science and Philosophy Destroy Christian Faith.
So that's the premise he was coming from is a very Richard Dawkins kind of premise. You know, he's not going to be a Christianity counselor because reason wipes it out as a rational possibility. So that's why I chose this question. Is Christianity conducive to doing good science? And his answer was no. And he presented his case. You can go to the internet to find his case if you want.
I wonder if you could comment on the demise of rationalism. I mean, on the surface, it seems if you have sound first principles, what could be more certain than making sound deductions from them? But I guess we don't believe in those first principles being as second.
Well, I think it was either Euler, or maybe it was Gauss in the 18th century who thought that Newton's laws of physics were a priori truths. And that's the danger of this. You can put so much confidence in the power of human reason if you think the world you make on paper must be the world really that exists outside. How many self-consistent mathematical formulations could you make of mathematics that don't correspond to the physical world outside? That's the ultimate question, isn't it?
I don't know if anybody could answer how many don't.
Galileo was right. It's the world on paper. Or is it the sensible world of experience? And he was responding, of course, to the Aristotelian character in his dialogues, the one who's always lampooned in his dialogues. But the Aristotelian is creating a world on paper that doesn't correspond to the sensible world.
We've got 5 more minutes. If you want to keep asking Ted questions or open it up for Doug or Bill, that's fine too.
Ted, I know you talked about this a little bit yesterday, but with all these quotes and this line of reasoning, why are we so reluctant to attribute to Christianity the rise of modern science?
Well, that's a very different question. It's a much more complex question, historically. I'm on record as having written that I don't believe Christianity caused modern science. I think it shaped modern science in some pretty important ways, and I've hinted at in this presentation. That's a very different claim. I mean, you could claim, if you want to take the simple logic that Christianity caused modern science, then in my view, you can also take the simple logic that Archimedes caused modern science. I don't see modern science happening without Archimedean mathematics, which is what Galileo, Kepler, and Newton all use. I mean, the reason most modern physicists can't just pick up the Principia and flat read it is because it's not written in ordinary calculus as we use it today. It's written with Archimedean geometry. And you have to go back and learn how to do that. You know, they haven't done it since 10th grade. And so you have to go back and do that again to derive the propositions. So Archimedes is a powerful force. Many other things could be brought in here as other single causes of modern science if you want to get there. As for science itself, there's a view some Christian apologists hold that I don't agree with, that Christianity causes science in the first place. You know, Greek science is somehow stillborn because it lacks a certain theological ethos. I'm not sympathetic with that either. I think there was genuine science in the ancient world, and cultural factors led to its demise. I mean, it never really did flourish in very many places. That's a cultural factor more than I think a theological factor.